Anton Andrew was born in Washington, D.C., the son of West Indian immigrants, before receiving his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Pennsylvania and his law degree from Hofstra University. He currently sits on the boards of the Nature Conservancy's Delaware chapter and of Open Connections, an educational nonprofit. He is running for the Democratic nomination in the 160th Pennsylvania House District. The 160th spans Delaware and Chester counties and includes Bethel Township, Chads Ford, Concord Township, and part of Upper Chi. Anton Andrew, welcome to the Delco Young Democast.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. So we like getting started just by kind of going over some of the basics. So, you know, where exactly did you grow up? What was your family like at the time?
And, oh, you know, cool. Sort of I grew up all over. I was born in Washington, D.C., but my parents are both West Indian. They met at Howard University. Okay. My mom was a nurse there. My dad was finishing up his master's degree. They fell in love, had me, were not finished with school, so sent me down to live with my grandmother. They finished up school and came down, and we lived in Jamaica until I was 7, then moved to Trinidad, where my dad's from, for a few years. Lived there till I was 10. Then moved up to Long Island because it had the best school districts in the state, and my parents were fully committed to getting me a decent secondary education so that I could pursue, you know, my American dream, or what they thought my American dream should look like.
Yeah, sometimes it doesn't exactly work out as planned, but usually works out somehow.
Oh, yeah, they're pretty proud now. I mean, they're telling all their friends. They're like, yep, see, we knew it would work out the whole time. I wasn't quite as confident when I first moved back here, so.
But, excellent. Yeah. So, you know, were they active in politics or in the community or anything like that when you were growing up?
My mother's brothers, two of them were involved in politics in Jamaica. Okay. And so, and my granddad had a sort of honorary mayor's position in town just because people knew him for a while, and any dispute that would pop up, they'd go to him to resolve. So, yeah, they were very involved. My family was. And actually, part of the reason they left Jamaica when they did in the late 70s was because the political situation was getting pretty tense. One of my uncles had gotten shot.
Oh, wow.
He lived, but sort of the writing was on the wall there that it was time to to move on. Plus, they, like I said, they wanted to make sure that I had a chance to go to school in the States and, you know, pursue a secondary education in college after that.
Yeah, I was only kind of vaguely aware that there was, like, some political tensions in Jamaica in that era, but, that's kind of brings it into real sharp focus.
I remember very vividly somebody driving down the block, or street, not really a block, in a orange Volkswagen Beetle, and it was just the wrong color for that area, and, like, a couple miles up the street, I remember us driving up the street a little later to go to the beach or something, and the car was flipped over on the side of the road.
Oh my God.
It looked like there were gunshots in it. Nobody told me what was going on, but I was like, yeah, I guess people take politics really seriously.
Yeah, I thought things were
getting divided here.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. No. Well,
oh my goodness.
That actually puts things into a great perspective.
Yeah,
in that regard.
Yeah. They're
right.
Yeah.
It doesn't look so bad right now.
I was going to say, yeah, in Jamaica, you know, part of, I think, the laid back attitude is people say, you know what, there are so many. In the States, we have first world problems.
Yeah.
Jamaica, we have third world problems. We have, you know, power means so much to the people there. And I think it's actually starting to weave its way into American politics, where people, once they get into power, their only goal is to keep power. Mm. Because the cost of not having power, at least in their own minds, is so great that they sort of lose sight of the people who give them that power, you know, the voters. But anyway, long story short, I love living in Jamaica. Aside from those incidents, which to me were, as a child, were just curious. Yeah, it was a great time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, given that experience, you know, when did you sort of connect with the political process for yourself?
Actually, it took me a while. I was just trying to connect with people when I got to the States, to be honest. Just this overweight kid with a funny accent. I was kind of struggling in school. So I just wanted to have some friends. And it was almost all white district and a large Jewish population there. So I just felt completely out of place, much wealthier than my family. We were living in the basement of my uncle's home just so we could be in the district. So it was a challenge. So socially, I was just trying to connect with people. It wasn't until I got to college, basically. And when I got to college and University of Pennsylvania, I felt like I had a chance to reinvent myself. Nobody knew who I was. The accent was gone. The weight was gone. I was like, okay, I get to be anything I want to be. And this is something that's always been interesting to me. And I got involved with the student government, largely because I wanted to meet girls. I wanted to go around and knock on the door.
I was just
going to
say, that's
hey,
a first. I haven't heard that one.
Honesty is important.
No,
right?
And I don't take offense.
That's a
respectable
answer.
Right. I mean...
No, it evolved into a lot more because at that moment, like a lot of the doors that I was knocking on, the female doors, a lot of people, the main complaint or concern on campus at the time was public safety. There had been a series of robberies and armed robberies. Oh. There had been a couple sexual assaults involving students who were inebriated and, you know, didn't leave fraternity houses or just. And so I created a neighborhood watch group where basically I enlisted a bunch of people who got trained by the Philadelphia Police Department, basically to be at all the parties on campus on any given weekend. And if somebody was inebriated or felt unsafe going back to their dwelling on campus or within a couple blocks off campus, that you'd have escorts, poorly chosen name, but at the time it made sense. Walk with that person, most of them were young ladies, back to their dorm room to make sure they got there safely. And so that was my first sort of entree into politics.
Then how did you sort of, you know, become a Democrat then? You know, was it sort of like one flashpoint where you realized that was the philosophy that made sense to you, or was it sort of more of a gradual sort of series of events?
I was going to say it's probably more gradual. I got here at a time, and my political awakening sort of happened right around the time that Ronald Reagan was, you know, coming into ascension within the Republican Party. And I have to say, the message was really intoxicating. You're like, wow. And after going to a couple young Republican meetings on campus just to get an idea if this is a fit for me, just felt like the priorities of immigrants and people who struggle, people who are working class and middle class, just weren't addressed there. It just didn't feel like a good fit. And so started spending more and more time with other Democrats. I don't think I was involved in any campus group per se in terms of a party, but just found myself spending more and more time with people who were sort of like-minded and said, I don't come from privilege. I don't think I'm going to end my life in privilege, and I'd like a government that recognizes that part of its job is to take care of the welfare of all its citizens.
Yeah, that shining city on a hill concept sounds
exactly.
Really nice, but you know, if that's what they were actually working for, it would be a lot nicer.
Yeah.
But all right, so you're, other than your student government experience, you are a first-time candidate.
Absolutely.
So, you know, can you talk about any sort of like political mentors or coaches that you've been able to rely on through the process?
I can talk about mentors. Political mentors, I'd say, again, my uncles, watching them as a child, I remember particular, there was a strike on the island, and remember having a Christmas party at my granddad's house, and he'd invited some of the workers who were striking, and there were some of the business owners who, you know, it was really tense. And I remember I was running around the room just hyped up. I think I was sipping Coke out of everybody's glasses, not realizing it was probably rum and Coke.
Oh,
but,
man.
And I ran up and I got in the stairs and I, like, a staircase on top, and I shouted down, like, in front of the room, silly little Chago, people must work really hard for their money. And the whole room gave me a round of applause. It's like, this politics stuff is easy. and like a couple days later, the strike ended. And I was like, I ended the strike. So, but as a mentor, I have to say, Will Thomas, one of my trial partners in Miami. And he was actually the first openly gay judge to run for the federal judiciary, or seeking appointment. He got blackballed. Marco Rubio, thank you. But he was brilliant, and he just kept on talking to me. Like, my entire experience as a public defender, just, it felt like triage. You just, people are coming in, getting arrested. You get them out of trouble if you're lucky, and then you see him again in a couple weeks or a couple months. And it can wear on you. And he kept on saying, hey, Anton, realize we're just a really small part. And he said, even then, I was confident he was going to be a judge because he was just had a real much larger picture. Started thinking about, okay, what is it that we can do proactively? And so I was fortunate while I was there to work on alternatives to incarceration for juveniles, which was pretty proactive for the time. As opposed to just simply, you know, getting people out of jail. But, okay, how do we keep them from getting into the system? And then I started having a sense of, okay, there's more that I can do. And there's, and triage is fantastic, and it's exhilarating. And, it, you know, you feel that kick of adrenaline every time you walk somebody out the courtroom door. But something that just stays with you for much longer is sort of being proactive, and that's what politics is. It's about being proactive and coming up with solutions, and, you know, working with other people to come up with solutions for the challenges that they're facing.
Makes a lot of sense. All right, so why now, and why the 160th?
Well, the complex answer probably has a lot to do with my upbringing, and, you know, trying to fit in and wanting to help other people and trying to be a good son and not bringing shame to my family and rewarding my parents for the incredible sacrifice. They really started their lives over just to give us an opportunity, my sister and I, and all that. But the simple answer is somebody asked me. One of the parents of one of my students came up to me and said, you know, Anton, somebody really needs to run in this district because our incumbent increasingly is ignoring the voices of not only Democratic voters, but Republican voters as well. There's a consensus among them. They want, you know, a quality education for all the kids in this area without breaking our backs with, you know, skyrocketing property taxes to ensure that education. They want to fix the budget deficit without slashing important services and programs, and they want, you know, better protections for the environment and individual rights. And I think before he even finished, I was already nodding like, yeah, I'm going to do this, because that's what I'd been doing my whole life as a public defender, working at Cheney University, working with, you know, the stuff you said, with the Nature Conservancy, the Land Conservancy for Southern Chester County, teaching at Open Connection. So I think before he even asked the question, he knew the answer. But yeah, the idea of anybody silencing other people's voices is a trigger for me. I've never, ever been able to walk away when that happens. My whole life, like going to law school, I thought I was going to work for these huge insurance defense firms on Long Island. They pay you crazy money.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like a little known secret, Hofstra has the third highest starting salaries of any law school in the country. It's not the third best law school, and no offense to Hofstra, but it's because they had all these huge defense firms around the area, and kids just went right into them and got paid super well. And I was thinking I was going to do the same thing until a couple incidents in my life. One where some friends got arrested, another where I worked in a legal clinic. And I was like, no, if I can give other people a voice, that's what I'm going to do. Same thing when I came to Cheney. Other opportunities presented itself, but I keep liking to say, I choose the social profit whenever I get a chance. It's like the monetary profit, that's okay. I'm fine. I didn't come from a lot. I don't expect I'll end up with a lot, but the social profit is, yeah, that's the thing that geeks me out. I get excited every day to, like, go to my job.
So, first time?
Yeah.
Running. Has there been a moment or something that's come along that has surprised you in the campaign, in the whole process, maybe?
Yeah. There's not a day that goes by without something surprising me. But the thing that constantly surprises me is how much people are willing to give of themselves to support me. It is so humbling. Like, everybody who's working on my campaign, except for my consultants, they're volunteers. They have busy lives. They have families. I know this because I've instructed several young people in their families. I know how busy their lives are. And yet they are constantly there to support me, to push me on, even when I'm tired. So that's one thing. I wish I could replicate that for every voter out there who feels alone and feels tired and nobody listens to me and nobody cares. You feel like you're in your silo, because I feel like I'm surrounded by like a support network. I never knew that's what was going to, you know, happen out of this. But to me, that's been the most surprising and the most pleasantly surprising part of the process. And like a close second would be seeing how excited the voters are. Like, I was just out knocking on some doors yesterday. One woman's like, I've got to introduce you to my neighbor. And she grabbed my arm and she's walking me down her block. And she's like, yeah, you've got to meet him, Joy. He's going to listen to you and he's going to make sure. And they start to get some stuff done in Harrisburg. I'm like, you don't know me from Adam. You really don't. But just that energy and just that instantaneous connection around, hey, we want something better for ourselves. That is like, I don't know.
It gets addicting, right? When you hear because I think there's a lot of that apathy that you know, we're all afraid of, you know, the voter apathy. So then when you get someone that's so engaged and then dragging you down the street, you know, to meet her neighbor, it's kind of like, oh, let's do this again, you know, and how many times can we replicate it, right?
Yeah, and you're right. And there are a lot of sort of tedious parts of the process as well that wear you down. So it's so great that, you know, when you get out there and the voters, you say, yeah, this is why I'm doing it, because there are people out there who really, really want, it's not just some mental exercise. There are real people who are being really impacted by this. Yeah. Who are out there to help you and are looking for somebody who's going to raise a voice on their behalf.
So you've placed fiscal responsibility first on your website.
Did I?
You did, actually. Okay. Yeah.
I was just going to say, we check. Yes. We double check these things. Do you think that breaking the constant budget log jams in Harrisburg is the most important issue facing the Commonwealth, since it is number one on your webpage?
I think there's several important issues facing the Commonwealth. And I think I think growing the economy is the easiest way for the government to help all its citizens. And so when I talk about fiscal responsibility, I'm talking about making investments in education and infrastructure, not only because it's the right thing to do morally or ethically, because I know I certainly benefited from a public education. My parents would not have moved back to the United States if they didn't wholeheartedly believe in that. But it's also the fiscally smart thing to do. You invest a dollar in education, you get $1.60 back. You do that in infrastructure, and you get a similar amount back. There's no other government investment that even comes close to those levels of investment. So whether you support it for the moral, the ethical, whatever reason you support it for, there's still a strong fiscal justification for doing that. And so that's why I put it there, because I think all voters can appreciate the benefit of being prepared so that they can pursue the American dream.
Absolutely. You've worked with several environmental nonprofits and talk about the need for renewable energy investment in Pennsylvania. What policies would you pursue in Harrisburg to encourage sustainable economic development that works with both our natural and man-made resources?
That is an excellent question. that is a great question. So I'll break it down into parts. So let's see. In terms of economic and community economic development, that's something that I first really got to see up close when I helped establish a center and was the first director for the Disadvantaged Business Enterprises Supportive Services Center at Cheney University, which basically gave training to women and minority-owned small businesses so that they could better compete for large transportation and construction contracts. And the more I learned about that, and I have to admit, I went into that process with very little knowledge, but I'm so appreciative to the president, Dr. Pettis at Cheney University, who trusted my professionalism, that I would be able to get it done. But you realize, as I said with infrastructure, supporting small businesses in the Commonwealth means that those businesses create well-paying jobs in the Commonwealth. And those people who in the Commonwealth are making that money, are spending that money, are being taxed here. The money is created here. It stays here. It's a virtuous cycle. It keeps going around. And then there's more money for other businesses to come. And then there's more money to develop the infrastructure further, which attracts even more business. So I absolutely think that has to be a priority. With regard to the environment, I think there's many ways we can incentivize the environment. Right now, I'm really excited about the water fund that the Nature Conservancy has. And I'd encourage you guys, if you look it up in the Nature Conservancy Delaware, if you type in water fund, you should be able to find it. But basically, it encourages downstream corporate or downstream manufacturing users to invest in upstream programs to keep the streams and the water supply clean. Sorry about hitting the mic. I'm getting excited. I'm starting to gesticulate. Because of the benefits, the financial benefits, because they have to do a lot of mitigation by the time it gets down to them. A lot of energy, a lot of chemicals, and it costs them a ton of money. If they invest upstream, again, a strategic investment upstream saves them a ton of money downstream. Plus, there are added benefits that they can get from the government for doing that. So, incentivizing businesses to make smart environmental choices is something that I would be a huge proponent of, and I've had a little bit of experience with the Water Fund, also with the Chester County Renewable Energy Leaders. I'd encourage people to check that out. Delaware County has a similar program. Basically, making the case for the environment on a business level, because I think too often it gets tossed out as, oh, well, that's just tree huggers or granola or whatever. I don't know what the disparaging term you can think of for somebody who cares about preserving the environment for future generations. And it gets too easily dismissed that way. I think Pennsylvania is one of the worst states with regard to protecting its environment. You look at the Department of Environmental Protection and how they were defunded, to the tune of about $80 million into the Corbett administration. That's shocking, because that's the same time we have the boom in fracking. So at a time when you need more people to be very careful about a very dangerous process in a very densely populated area, you're gutting that agency. It's not a coincidence. It's distressing and alarming, but I'm veering off from your question. So,
please, the Mariner East 2. Well, this actually ties into the Mariner East 2 pipeline is slated to run through one of the towns you're looking to represent. The construction has been stopped and started for what feels like a zillion times.
At least once a month, that's stopping the project. Mm-hmm. Rightfully so.
Mm. Sinkholes are opening up. Safety violations are the norm. What would you do to protect your constituents from this pipeline?
So the first part of it, what I mentioned earlier, is, again, properly funding the Department of Environmental Protection. Yeah, I'm getting excited here. I'm starting to eat my words.
I've been doing it the whole interview. It's okay.
All right. So we're in a sort of unique situation. Not sort of. We are in an extremely unique situation. Where we are in Chester and Delaware counties with regard to the Mariner East project, there is no place else in the country, and I don't believe any place else in the world, where you have people, that density of population, in proximity to a pipeline that's transporting liquefied natural gas. So I say liquefied because people sometimes don't understand how inherently volatile that is. We are putting 1,200 pounds per square inch of pressure on natural gas to keep it in that liquid form, just so it can flow in the pipelines. If you are a kid and you, like me, like to blow stuff up, you know that substances like to return to their natural form. Those gases want to return to gaseous state. Mm-hmm. We're putting them in communities that are densely packed, have lots of businesses, and it is a great situation for energy transfer partners, the parent corporation of Sunoco, because they get a straight shoot to huge markets along the Northeast Corridor, and they get huge profits from that. But that means you're putting a large chunk of your population at risk. So our first priority is to absolutely protect the physical safety of the citizens who are in the way of the pipeline. And in addition to the Department of Environmental Protection, I think we have to look at applying FERC laws, because those are federal laws that work with interstate transmission. And as much as Sunoco likes to talk about, yeah, we abide by all regulations, they get around FERC regulations because the Mariner East is considered a Pennsylvania project. The Mariner West is an Ohio project. Guess what? The Mariner East and Mariner West meet. They're coming on interstate lines. But if they were held to the FERC standards, I have no doubt they could not meet those FERC standards, even on the very basic level where, well, I won't go into any more.
It's beautiful.
No, please. I mean, this is what people like to hear.
Okay. I don't think people want to hear this because
this is what I like
people
to hear.
People are in harm's way. Yeah. Uh-huh. There is no easy way to put that. People are in harm's way, and we need to be absolutely certain that they are safe, and we need to hold them to that standard to say, hey, first of all, why is it that no place else in the country would do this? Why is it that nowhere else in the country would put their citizens at risk? Well, because they know it's an inherently dangerous process. If you're going to have an inherently dangerous process, then you need to make sure that they are crossing all their T's, dotting all their I's, doing everything right. 48 violations and counting later, they're not even coming close to that. Their standard of care for energy transfer partners, if you look at this corporation, and I have, you look at their standard of care, they are an outlier within the industry. And by an outlier, I don't mean a good outlier. They have had more violations than the next 10 highest competitors. The next 10, okay? So there is nothing that gives me confidence that they are looking out for the public's best interest, which means it's up to the legislators to make sure we hold them to that high standard.
Now it gets scary.
Yeah. And then the second part of that is, if somehow they meet that standard, then the next question is the public welfare. Well, we have given you an exception as a public utility to go out and seize land through eminent domain and to be in these communities and endangering citizens. What is the public benefit as required by every public utility? We're not seeing any public benefit from it right now. So when people talk about the Marcellus shale tax and, oh, that's going to drive the industry away, make no doubt about it. They are in such a prime and plum location. The shale tax is walk-around money. It's not going to drive them out of town. Yeah. So first of all, make sure we're safe. Then we can leverage the fact that you guys have, we basically given you everything in the kitchen sink, and now it's time for you to give back. And I'm sorry about banging the table.
If there was a pressurized gas pipeline running 400 feet from my kid's school, I would be angry. But
yeah. I would have been like sitting on the pipe and in mid-construction being like, nope, stopping it now.
Because I don't think
moving.
A lot of people know about that. And that's part of defunding the Department of Environmental Protection. And that's part of the sort of nomenclature that Sunoco uses instead of calling it a blast zone or what I would call an incineration zone. Because I know that's what I hear firefighters when firefighters talk about. If something happens within the impact or the high impact probability zone, which is what I think the Sunoco calls it.
Which is, now that I think about it, you're right. Like, you're
that's
like, impact. We're not talking about impact. We're talking about, like, done.
Exactly.
Bye.
Firefighters say, and this was, I mean, I don't want to misquote. I heard a firefighter saying at a West Whiteland township meeting, I think last October, was quoted as saying, there is not a lot of rescue that's going to be going on in that zone. Which is saying, yeah, it's a recovery effort after the fact. We realize within that zone, within 1,800 to 2,000 feet of those pipes, if we have a major incident, yeah, that's what we're looking at, recovery. And then even in an evacuation zone, which is goes out half a mile away from the pipelines, the evacuation zone where they evacuate people upwind, people would have to do that on foot. People can't evacuate by cars because cars create sparks. Yeah. And then exactly, you put a gas around a spark, you have a catalyst for an even more horrific incident. People can't use cell phones for that same matter because of that. And I don't think the public is fully aware. And again, I don't want to be alarmist. I want to make sure that people know of the full risk so that we can put procedures and steps in place to make sure that we mitigate that risk. But to just simply say, oh, well, yeah, they're abiding by all the rules, and yeah, they have screw-ups every now and then. Those screw-ups can be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, absolutely. You know.
I feel like a lot of lawmakers and leaders in this country have a hard time fighting these issues because of certain campaign finance laws. Obviously, I'm sure you're aware. Do you think that's something that you know, this is kind of a broad question, but needs reform?
Absolutely.
Finance.
I think I still marvel and I'm fascinated by the Citizens United case. But in terms of campaign finance, I think we need much more transparency. I think transparency is probably the concept that is most missing from the legislative process right now. It's so opaque. People have no idea why people are doing what they're doing, other than it doesn't make sense, which it leads more and more voters to be disengaged, which gives politicians more and more power to follow their own dangerous political agendas. And so I absolutely would be pushing for campaign finance reform, making sure that the public knows who is financing who and to what level. And anything that will help make politicians more responsive to the people who give them the power that they're exercising.
So you have three kids attending public school.
Actually, they attend Open Connections.
Yeah. I thought that was a supplemental sort of thing.
It is a supplemental.
So now,
because
wait
homeschool.
A minute. Now what is?
And they also attend Open Connections a couple days a week. And I also have been an instructor there for the last several years. Think of it like,
I was just going to say, now you have to give me like a real quick rundown of what Open Connection, cause I have children as well. So really? I'm like, okay,
come out and visit us. You know what? If you wait long enough, there's supposed to be a documentary about us coming out at Sundance next year, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, February or something, like early next year.
I'm going to come visit instead of waiting that long.
All right. That's fine. But it's almost like, I don't know, in college where you can survey a course, where you can sit in the course, you can get exposed to the information. We also do, you know, a lot of collaborative problem solving and a lot of real work. So the curriculum's based around, you help choose the content idea. The young people, every 6 weeks, they give input as to where they want to go. The older students actually come in during the summer to help design the curriculum. They spend several days during the summer meeting. And then basically they get together into groups. They do collaborative group projects. They do real work projects on the campus and off the campus.
And what age?
From 4 to 18.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
You can come from 1 to 4 days a week.
I am literally like so geeking because so
it is.
Well, so as a parent who has had either both and they're currently both in public school,
okay.
But my oldest has been in public school. He's been in a private school. He's been homeschooled. He's even been through online school because I wanted to find where he could fit in, you know, best learning wise. So hearing that is really fascinating to me.
Well, it seems like a real form of education.
And that's why mine went in, because I didn't like the way that the public schools testing was, and
I've been in public schools, and I'm currently in a parochial school system up in Radnor, and it's teaching for the test,
right? You know? Yeah. Right, and that's just
so education on the whole isn't at all where it has to be. So this sounds like a really interesting, different, and probably better form of education.
I'm telling you, it was so exciting.
And I'd be
so
curious to read more about it.
I'm happy. I could go on for hours, and I think we can have that separate meeting. I don't want to torture your listeners with that.
Not at all.
No, that's very interesting though. But I was under the wrong impression. But it's it's kind of an even more, more interesting point, knowing that the kids are homeschooled.
Yeah. Open connections?
No. So what's interesting is we were, discussing, and what was it called again?
Open connections.
Open connections. Because,
it's
you
Newtown
know.
Newtown Square, 1616 Delchester Road.
Which is hysterical because it's well, not only that, it's nice. Literally right up the road from me. And I'm like, didn't even notice this. Pennsylvania regularly falls $3 to $4 billion short in the state's share of school funding, which leaves the individual districts to pick up the slack. That means there are school districts in Delaware County struggling for basic funding, while some others in wealthier areas have everything they could want and more. What would you do in Harrisburg to help eliminate this wealth gap between the rich and poor school districts in the state?
Well, the very first and obvious step is to increase state funding for public education. I think right now we're at somewhere in the low 30s in terms of what the state funds education like. In terms of percentage-wise, 32% of the entire cost comes from the state. That means local school districts are forced to raise property taxes year after year to fill that huge gap. And I know when I first moved here and I looked at my property tax bill living in Kennett Township, where the schools are successful because the property taxes are so high, I thought this was absurd. I said, but you know what? If that's what it takes so that our kids can have an education. But that's not a sustainable formula, first of all, because even within my district, more and more parents, including young parents, can't afford to live there because the property taxes are insanely high. And in districts where the property taxes, even if they are high because the property values are low, those schools are severely underfunded. And those kids don't stand a chance. I don't like to be an alarmist, but as a public defender, when we were in Miami, there were three school districts that were really underfunded in Miami. And we'd be sitting in juvenile court, myself, the lawyers, the judges, and we'd go, I won't name the school. XYZ. We just point to the juvenile client and say, okay, that person is from X, that's from Y, that's from Z, because it's as a very direct correlation. You have underfunded schools, you're dealing with the mess on the tail end. And so absolutely making sure that we increase state funding for public education as the first step.
Yeah, just being, I think I'm the only homeowner on the show end here, knowing that even in a school district as underfunded as Upper Darby, my property taxes are basically exactly the same as my mortgage payment. Like split 50-50 with what I pay every month. It's absolutely obscene. And, it stops a lot of people, especially younger people. It prices them out of the housing markets.
And which is
distressing.
Which creates an interesting dynamic, because if you look at large parts of my district, in the 160th, you have places where you have 55 and over communities, where you have high density housing, lots of 55 and over people paying very high property taxes, supporting schools that they get no benefit from. And when they complain about that, one of the responses I actually heard at a PTO meeting was, well, if you don't like it, move out. And I'm thinking, if those people move out, your schools become the schools you are afraid of in other districts because they're going to be severely underfunded. Wow. But again, it puts us in an unsustainable position where property taxes are the only way that local government leaders know to fill that gap. So, which I'm going to go back to something you said earlier about Marcella Shale, about politicians and where money comes from. I think one of the things that's really attractive to politicians, including in the Democratic Party, is, well, what about a Marcella Shale tax? That'll take care of everything. And then we can balance our budget. And it sounds lovely. Exactly. It sounds lovely. And it certainly will bring jobs. How much the economic benefit is, it can be argued, but I'm not going to dismiss that. The question is, if you are entirely committed, if that's your only solution to taking care of that problem, then the die is cast. We're no longer putting public safety first. I think a better solution is to make strategic investments in community and economic development. Again, because it's a proven way of building an economy, as opposed to relying purely on taxes, especially taxes on dangerous industries or sin taxes where you have lottery taxes. Not saying I wouldn't consider that, because they certainly do bring in money, but at the same point, they're aggressive. They are dangerous in its terms of like Marcella Shale. So we need to look at other options, and making strategic investments is one of those options.
Amanda, do you want to take that last partisan divide?
Do I want to take it?
Well, I'm not talking to you. We're going to model partisan divide.
But I was just going to say, partisan divide on that one, baby. So the partisan divide in Harrisburg is as bad as ever. How can you work to get legislation through without compromising your democratic values?
That's a really good question. It isn't something I've really worried about, and people have raised that to me, so let's see. I think largely because of the way I approach politics, again, the idea of power to me is it's a gift. It's an ethical responsibility that I have. If people put me in office, the only reason I'm there is to serve those people. So losing sight of my values, I can't imagine that happening. For 25 years, I've been working in environments that have not always been conducive or not always been welcoming. I've worked in Miami at a time when we're dealing with Janet Reno as a state attorney in Miami, and then her successor, I won't name her name, but tried to out Reno Janet Reno, just cracking down on crime. Worked at Cheney at a time when the state funding formula basically was rewarding schools that took high achieving students and sent them on to grad schools, which wasn't Cheney's mission. So I working where the skids have been greased against you, where you're working uphill, isn't something that's daunting for me, because sort of the joy for me is in the process of like, hey, I get to go out there and every day fight for your voice, because I know how hard it was to fight for my voice. When I first came here, it took me, you know, a decade until I was at Penn before I felt like I had mine. So I was like, yeah, what's another decade fighting to make sure that somebody else has a voice? So, yeah, it's something I look forward to. It's something that's sort of in my DNA, so I can't see how that would change. It's not like, oh, I just got up this morning and said, you know what, I'd like to start helping other people out, and we'll see how this works, and if it backfires, then I'm screwed. But no, I've been doing it for 25 years. Sometimes it backfires, but always enjoy.
And I think a lot of issues that you touch on in this discussion, more people agree with than disagree with.
Yeah, that's a growing consensus that, you know, our representatives are ignoring, which is why I got off my... I can't say that word.
You can if you like.
Rhymes at bass. Why I got off my rear end and left what I love doing.
That was a slick catch.
Yeah,
that was right on the... That was right on
the cusp.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so speaking of words that rhyme with bass, your general election opponent...
Nice.
He's sitting here very straight faced, by the way. He finds no humor in this at all.
No, none whatsoever.
No, I'm nodding my head. Just disgusted.
So, Representative Stephen Barrar was one of the Republicans who voted last week to gut HB 722, which is the bill that would form a public redistricting committee to fight partisan gerrymandering. What message would you have both for him and for our listeners on that particular issue?
For Steve Barrar, I'd say, way to stick to the script. You've been doing it for 21 years. You've been unapologetic about gerrymandering. You've told people it's basically the spoils of victory. So for you to gut it at this point, hey, at least you're consistent. We know you're really good at that one thing. For the rest of the voters, if you wonder why we have that level of partisanship that we do in Harrisburg, look at gerrymandering. When leaders only have to respond to their handlers and the political hacks who cut up the districts so that they can get reelected, because those are the people who have power over your life now, instead of the voters, well, then who are you going to respond to? I absolutely was not at all surprised that happened. I'm sorry to say, but it didn't surprise me, because people who are in Harrisburg right now are so invested in staying in power, and the way they stay in power is by choosing their voters instead of their voters choosing them. So I would tell the voters, time for you to start choosing your elected officials again. Make sure you find out who got in the way of HB 72, who got in the way, and make sure you vote them out of office. I mean, it become a single issue voter on that issue, because if you want any sort of partisanship, if you want any sort of movement in government, well, you're not going to get it as long as government officials feel their only loyalty to the people who are drawing their districts.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Stephen Barrar has been in office for 21 years. The 160th hasn't been represented by a Democrat for the past 40 years. Wow. You know, what do you think makes you the person to take on Stephen Barrar and the Republicans? I mean, you do have a primary opponent, Kathy Sparr.
I do.
And we have spoken to.
Sorry. No. Yeah, we have two great candidates. And I think part of the reason we have two great candidates is because both of us can see a path to victory to beating Stephen Barrar. I think Stephen Barrar, should I get through the primary, cannot claim that, hey, he's inexperienced. He hasn't been a decision maker. He hasn't been responsible for multi-million dollar projects with stakeholders all over the Commonwealth. I have that experience. Or he can't say he doesn't know how to write laws or rules or enforce them. I have that experience as a lawyer, as the social equity officer at Cheney, where I wrote all the laws around harassment and discrimination, and I enforced all the rules there as well. Any advantage an incumbent has is usually going to be termed or phrased in the E word, experience. The times are too important to put an inexperienced leader there. Well, that's not an argument he's going to have with me. I also think the fact that I can talk about making strategic investments and I can talk about specifically how to mitigate for environmental harm and individual rights will also be compelling to voters, Republicans and Democrats, who are a little on the fence, who are afraid of somebody who will be so partisan that they can't work with other people and that they don't understand the issues clearly enough to be able to be effective once they get in an environment where something like what happened this week with that gerrymandering bill can happen. So I think that that takes an understanding of the process, and I think I have an understanding of that process as well. So basically, I think between my message and my experience, the sort of advantage that Steve Barrar would gain from his experience in office isn't going to be dispositive. And I think his record speaks for itself.
Yeah, that's certainly true. So, you know, we're obviously gearing the show towards younger audience. So what other issues do you think the millennial and Generation Z voters are going to be concerned with in this election?
Having not been a millennial or a Generation Z voter in this millennia, I can guess. And I would say just recently I was speaking to a couple, I was knocking on the door, and they were living with the wife's parents. And they were talking about just the fact that they couldn't afford a home in this district. They wanted their kids to go to school in the district, in the Kennett district, the Kennett Consolidated School District, and that they couldn't afford it because of the property taxes. And that basically it wasn't something that was an option for them. So I think I know at least for that couple, making sure, again, that we have a soundly funded educational system is huge. I know working with the Nature Conservancy in Wilmington and their cities program, the most avid stakeholders are young people. And I know I can remember back to when I was young, when I remember that is when I got involved in wanting to preserve the environment, just feeling passionate about, oh, these things that I love might not be here when I'm a grown up. No way. I'm going to get out in front of this. And then one thing that has come up for me a lot during the campaign, and I've heard from a lot of young people, whether people I've talked to, the high schools, I've spoken to a couple groups at high schools, is gun safety, in terms of common sense gun safety resolutions, which is something that I have been doing with all the local municipalities within my district. I have forwarded common sense gun resolution. I have, so far, three municipalities of the eight within the district have heard it. Two have adopted it, Kennett Township and Kennett Borough. Pocopson has heard it. And I'd encourage citizens in Pensbury, Chadsford, Upper Chichester, the Concord and Bethel area, to make sure they show up in the next month for their local meetings, because I have asked to put that resolution in the agenda, which basically says we want universal background checks. We want to make sure we keep guns out of the hands of convicted felons, and especially felons with a history of domestic violence. We want to make sure that we ban bump stocks. We want to make sure that semi-automatic assault rifles are banned because they have no place in a civil society. And I think that's an issue, even just seeing going to the March for Lives in Media in Westchester there, on the same day, and just seeing the turnout for that and the young people who are sort of leading those activities, I'm at one part of me is grateful to see that young people are sort of leading the activity. And part of me is deeply sad because it means the adults have failed them. It means they no longer trust that the adults who are quote unquote in power, I'm making the
quote fingers.
Yeah. Yep. Have done anything to address this serious issue. And I'll just end that by saying, I remember 1989, Stockton shooting, before your time, Ronald Ray, it was a shooting in a playground in Stockton, California at a school, and five immigrant children were killed. They're all like first generation, so it hit me because I was like, yeah, that could have been me playing in the playground. Ronald Reagan at the time said, assault weapons, or he said semi-automatic rifles, he goes, they're not sporting and they're not safety, and we need to make sure that they get out of civilian life. He said that in 1989, 30 years ago, a Republican president, an icon within the Republican Party. 30 years later, we haven't addressed that question. So I can absolutely see why young people will be frustrated about it. And that's why it's going to be one of my priorities, because I was shocked. They go, really? We haven't? We had the federal ban for a while, then we let it lapse, and the states, including Pennsylvania, haven't done anything about it. So, yeah, I think, you know, those three issues pop to mind, but any politician, and I tell young or old people, who tells you they have all the answers and knows all the answers is either dangerously deluded or corrupt. So, so I don't know what all the issues are. I would invite people to, you know, come onto my webpage, AntonAndrew.com, and contact me because all the information goes directly to me, or check out my Facebook page, which is Anton Andrew for State Representative, I believe. So
we love when they give it out.
Yeah, like,
hey,
yeah.
We didn't have to plug it for.
Yeah.
Oh, really? No, you probably would do it much better.
No, I thought it was great.
You did it justice, that's for sure.
Direct from the candidate is always best. So I want to kind of end it up on a little bit of a lighter note here.
Sure.
You
mean I'm not light? You're like me talking about kids getting slayed in playgrounds.
We're not really throwing him a bone here, in all fairness, though. This is.
But the food from your childhood.
Ooh.
Yes. Is there anywhere around here in Delaware County that we can get the good stuff?
My house.
Invite.
You want some ackee and saltfish? You want some Easter bun? You want some jerk chicken or jerk pork?
Ooh, yeah.
I think we just all had a collective what time is dinner.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. Wrap us up and head over after it now.
Yeah, we'll wrap done. Up the recording early.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. Anton, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on the Delco Young Democast.
Oh, man. The pleasure was all mine. Thank you, guys.